The following is a lecture given by His Grace Sataputta Prabhu on Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, 24th Chapter, Text 19. The lecture is given on October 14th, 1992, in San Diego.
Your son will be the head of all the perfected souls. He will be approved by the acharyas, expert in disseminating real knowledge. And among the people, he will be celebrated by the name Kapila. As the son of Devahuti, he will increase your fame. Srila Prabhupada. Sankhya philosophy is the philosophical system enunciated by Kapila, the son of Devahuti. The other Kapila, who is not the son of Devahuti, is an imitation. This is the statement of Brahma, and because we belong to Brahma's disciplic succession, we should accept his statement that the real Kapila is the son of Devahuti, and that real Sankhya philosophy is the system of philosophy which he introduced and which will be accepted by the acharyas, the directors of spiritual discipline. The word susamata means accepted by persons who are counted upon to give their good opinion. Om Anjana Timurandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Nilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupaka Dhammayam Dadati Svapadantikam. So the translation: your son will be the head of all the perfected souls. He will be approved by the acharyas, expert in disseminating real knowledge. And among the people, he will be celebrated by the name Kapila. As the son of Devahuti, he will increase your fame. So this verse is describing the avatar of Vishnu known as Lord Kapila, and it's pointed out that he would teach the Sankhya philosophy. So the Sankhya philosophy, of course, now we're going to go into the teachings of Lord Kapila in the next volume, so we'll learn a lot about the Sankhya philosophy. But this philosophical system describes the relationship between the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the energies that we directly have experience of in this world. And thus it establishes the link between what we directly experience with our senses and God. So therefore that's an important aspect of philosophy. It also explains our own situation in life, because it explains the nature of the soul, the subtle body, and the gross body, and the relationships between these different elements. So for this reason, the Sankhya philosophy is important for purposes of obtaining self-realization. It's the philosophical system that describes basically what the self is and how it works in relation to what we see and experience. So that's actually the importance of the Sankhya philosophy. Srila Prabhupada has said that Sankhya means counting or enumeration, and it's the analytical study of the material nature, both gross and subtle. So Srila Prabhupada also points out here that there's another Kapila, an atheist Kapila. So there's a imposter who is also putting forward a Sankhya philosophy which is atheistic. So in fact, in India, most of the time when people speak of Sankhya philosophy, they refer to the atheistic Sankhya philosophy. But that's because they've been bewildered by these invalid teachings. So the actual Sankhya philosophy is theistic. So just to summarize what the Sankhya philosophy contains, the most basic statement you could make is that, beginning with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, there are various energies. Krishna has many different types of energy. And these fall in three broad categories. There's the internal energy, yoga maya, by which Krishna manifests the eternal spiritual world and everything that is contained in it. Then there's the external energy, or material energy, and the marginal potency. The marginal potency consists of the infinitesimal spirit souls. So we are spirit souls. That is what we are in essence. And so we're part of this marginal potency. It's part of the energy of Krishna. Now the external energy is unique in the sense that it is not conscious, or it doesn't have the property of consciousness. The spirit souls, jivatma, are by nature conscious. They have what is called the chit potency. There are three fundamental features of Krishna, sat, chit, and ananda. So the sat refers to eternal being. Krishna exists eternally. There's no diminishing within Krishna. So this is the principle of sat. Then chit is the principle of knowledge, being able to know something. So being able to know something means to be conscious. The real definition of consciousness is that something is conscious if it has knowledge. The very word conscious says that, because kon means with, and the C-I-S-C-I-O-U-S means knowledge in Latin. It's the same root word that you find in science. Also, nescience means ignorance. So ne means negation, and then science means not knowledge. So conscious, to be conscious is to have knowledge, and the chit potency is the principle whereby an entity can have knowledge. So then ananda, this is the hladini shakti, or the principle of pleasure or enjoyment, and that is there in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these three principles of sat, chit, ananda are there within Krishna. And to a minute degree, these principles are also there within the jiva souls. The jiva soul is also by nature sat, chit, ananda. So, however, the material energy is different. In one sense, the fundamental basis of the material energy is also sat, because it's eternally existent. But the manifestations of material energy are all temporary. So they're asat, which is the opposite of sat. They come and go. And they're also achit. They don't have consciousness. Material manifestations don't have any awareness of anything, and thus they cannot have knowledge. Of course, we can record knowledge in a book, but by placing ink on paper in little shapes. But the book doesn't know the knowledge that is in the book. It's just an object, and the ink is just there on the paper, and that's all. It just sits there. Likewise, in a gross material body, in the brain, information could be stored up. They don't really know yet exactly how it happens, even though there's so much knowledge these days about the brain. But the idea is that by making different connections between neurons, you could code information. In a computer, you can store information in the form of electric charges on capacitors, for example, or magnetization of little magnets, and so on. which can, if it's magnetized one way, that means one, and the other way it means zero. So you can have ones and zeros, and with that you can make numbers. The numbers can stand for letters. The letters can make up a book. And so you can have a book stored in your computer. So, but the computer doesn't know anything. It has information in it, but it doesn't have knowledge, because it's not aware of anything. It's just an object or a thing. So that's the nature of the material energy. So the Sankhya philosophy describes this material energy. The fundamental principle underlying the material energy is called pradan. So that's an eternally existing energy of Krishna. So Krishna manipulates this pradan to create the material universes. And it's sort of like a person making a drawing or writing some message on a blackboard using chalk. You take the chalk and you write, and so now there's a message there, or else you make a drawing there. And then later you erase it, and the chalk still exists, but now the little particles of chalk are just arranged in a different pattern. So the writing that you had on the blackboard, or the drawing, now ceases to exist. So the material energy is like that. It's sort of a super blackboard system that Krishna makes use of. So sometimes he writes universes, as it were, and then he erases them. So all these manifestations are temporary, but the energy that they're made from, namely the pradhan, continues to exist. So scientists have a principle of conservation of energy, and actually that that principle is valid. However, it's not valid at the level at which the scientists present it. That's an interesting point. And physicists actually should be well aware of this, because since about sometime in the middle of the 19th century, they've had this principle of conservation of energy. But since that time, their definition of what energy consists of has changed on a regular basis. They keep adding to it, discovering new forms of energy, which means that their old definition of energy didn't satisfy conservation of energy, because they keep coming up with new definitions of energy. Therefore, whatever the old definition was, energy of that type wasn't conserved. For example, there's something called the neutrino, which is a subatomic particle. So there's a certain reaction in which atoms decay and give off an electron. It's called beta decay. And scientists observed that this beta decay does not conserve energy. This was observed back in the 1930s. And so the scientists were rather shocked by this, and they thought, well, this is terrible. It must be there's another particle that carries off the missing energy in beta decay. So I think it was Enrico Fermi who proposed it. He called it this mysterious particle the neutrino. And he just postulated it as something that would carry away the energy that seemed to be missing in beta decay, so that they could still have conservation of energy. And sure enough, at least according to the story the physicists tell, he was right, because later on they did discover the neutrino. So now they're convinced that it really exists. So in their equations for energy now, they also have neutrinos. Previously, they didn't have neutrinos, which means that previously their equations didn't really balance and they didn't really have conservation of energy. But now, scientists will still argue that if you propose that some non-physical mind causes the brain to do something, such as move my arm like this, then that violates conservation of energy. So that couldn't be. So scientists will argue like that. But it's not a very good argument, because Their definition of energy has been changing on a regular basis, so it can change again. And they can discover a new kind of energy, perhaps, which you could call mind energy. Why not? It's perfectly possible. In fact, there's a lot of empirical evidence for it, for the existence of mind as a separate kind of energy. In any case, the Sankhya philosophy does say that there is something that you could call mind energy. So that's all described by Lord Kapila in considerable detail. Basically, the pradhan is the, as I say, you can compare it to a blackboard, or you could compare it to clay that is molded by a sculptor to make different sculptures. You can take clay and mold that, and now you have a figure of a human being, let's say. Then you can wad it up, and that figure is gone. Then you can mold it into something else, and then wad that up, and so on. So, from this pradhan, which is like the basic clay, it's basically exists in two states. In one state, nothing is manifest. That's like the state of the clay in which it's just wadded into a ball. It doesn't have any particular form. Of course, a ball is a form, but in any case, so when the pradhan is in this state in which nothing is manifest, on some occasions, Mahavishnu will glance over it. When he glances over the pradhan, he injects into it the conditioned spirit souls which were stored up within his body in a state of suspended animation. And he also injects into it the time factor. This is described in the Brahma Samhita, and it becomes quite complex. But basically, when the time factor begins to operate within pradhan, things begin happening. False ego becomes manifest within pradhan, and then the three modes of material nature become manifest, and they begin to interact, and various elements are produced in a systematic order. Intelligence is produced from the mode of passion. Mind is produced from the mode of goodness. And from the mode of ignorance, the gross elements are produced beginning with ether, which is space. So initially, space is produced. This means material space, because there's also spiritual space. Spiritual space actually is the Brahma Jyoti, because that's the spiritual sky, and the Vaikuntha planets are floating within that. So that is Krishna's spiritual counterpart of space. So material space is different. It is the container. It's described actually by Lord Kapila. Ether, or space, is the container for all other material manifestations. That is, other material manifestations take place within it. And space also, and this is a somewhat unique idea, is the generating cause of the other gross elements, which are listed as air, fire, water, and earth. So everything that we see in ordinary experience is made up of air, fire, water, and earth in different proportions. But these elements are transformations of ether. So in one sense, they're nothing but ether. Interestingly enough, there are some scientists who have made a similar theory, because Einstein introduced the idea of space as a continuum that can be curved. His idea is that curvature of space creates gravity. That's a whole subject, Einstein's general theory of relativity. So another scientist named John Wheeler proposed that particles are made of curved areas of space. That is, where space curves in a certain way, that's a particle of matter. So all matter as we know it is just space that is curved in little lumps. So really there's nothing but space. So that's an idea somewhat similar to the idea in Sankhya philosophy. But it's only somewhat similar, because in Sankhya philosophy there are other aspects also. For example, the senses get linked up with the gross elements. This is an important feature because there's a basic question of how consciousness gets connected with matter. If matter doesn't have consciousness, then how is it that consciousness gets linked up with matter? So that, first of all, we're conscious of matter, and secondly, matter seems to be acting in a conscious way. That is, you see these bodies walking around, and they give evidence of being conscious. So that many people, including respectable scientists, think that matter is conscious, and they trace consciousness back to the brain. Actually, the reason they trace consciousness to the brain is that that's the point where things become so complicated that they can't trace things any further. They can't really understand the brain. It's too complicated. For example, it's said there, it used to be estimated that there were 10 billion neurons in the cerebrum. And then somebody made the comment that out of the 10 billion neurons in the cerebrum, at least 100 billion of them are found in one small part of the cerebrum. In other words, 10 billion was off. It was really 100 billion. Well, of course, actually nobody knows what 100 billion neurons are doing. Just consider that, trying to keep track of what's going on with 100 billion neurons. Just try to keep track of what 100 neurons are doing. That would be difficult. So you don't really know what they're doing in there. Nobody knows. But they'll say that whatever they're doing in there, they're generating consciousness. Consciousness is created by these neurons. And if you ask, well, how is consciousness created by the neurons? They'll say, well, we're thinking about that, and we're going to explain it. And you better not propose anything different, because you'll be awfully embarrassed when we actually do explain it, if you propose some different theory. This is the argument that they will ultimately give. Recently, there's a Scientific American issue devoted to the brain, and they had an article there strongly stating that we shall explain consciousness in terms of the brain. And the first thing we will do is explain visual perception, how you perceive something that you see. And once we explain that, then we'll explain other features of consciousness. So they're going to do it. So anyway, that's what they say. But no one has done it. So in any case, in the Sankhya philosophy, the link between consciousness and matter is explained. Basically, the gross elements of ether, air, fire, water, and earth are produced, and these are linked up with senses, namely hearing, touch, vision, taste, and smell, interestingly enough. So these senses get hooked up with the elements. It's something perhaps comparable to having a peripheral device hooked up to a computer. You can hook up a computer to your mouse. So once it's properly hooked up, then when you move the mouse, you can send information into the computer. So the mouse is like a material object, obviously. But when that link is established, then the computer picks up signals from the mouse. So we don't know exactly how it is done, but links are established between these senses and the material elements. So the senses, in turn, are linked up to the mind and the intelligence and the false ego. And finally, the false ego is linked up to the spirit soul. And the link there is Krishna himself. Now that's why the Sankhya philosophy has to be the theistic Sankhya philosophy if it's going to actually work. Because Krishna is essential in all of this. First of all, it was Krishna who set the elements into motion and transformation so as to create this whole system. And Krishna is also the source of the conscious spirit souls. And Krishna is the final link between the spirit soul and the element of false ego. So, in the atheistic Sankhya philosophy, basically what the atheists do, of course, is they just cut Krishna out of the picture completely. So they have this pradan with the elements manifest in it. And from what I understand, they say that that's eternal. The manifestation of the elements is eternally present. And spirit souls somehow or other are embedded in it. It's like a plum pudding. And the spirit souls are the plums embedded in it. And they're just drifting as a result of the interactions of the modes of nature. They have no power to do anything, but they're just adrift. And that's it. They just drift about undergoing different experiences as the modes of nature transform. And that's all that ever happens. That's the atheistic Sankhya philosophy. In a way, it's similar to the modern scientific philosophy. Modern scientific philosophy says there's nothing but material energy. It eliminates the spirit souls also. So there are no plums in the pudding. But the material energy is just transforming endlessly. And sometimes the transformations produce brains which make statements about consciousness, even though there really is no such thing. And then at other times the transformations just produce rocks and masses of gas and things like that. So that's the the atheistic Sankhya philosophy and modern scientific view are quite similar. So anyway, a brief summary. So the Sankhya philosophy is important because it really explains how our inner self is related to the material energy, and it explains the role that Krishna has in manipulating the material energy and creating the different manifestations. So that's what Lord Kapila is going to explain. So I'll stop there. Are there any questions or comments? Yeah?
Material scientists used to have this concept of ether, but they abandoned it some time ago.
Yeah, well, ether. The question is, what about the material scientists' concept of ether? Of course, they originally had the concept of ether because they inherited that from Aristotle. As a matter of fact, Aristotle had earth, air, fire, water, and ether. But he had his own theory about them. And one wonders if there was some contact with India there. It could well be that there was. In any case, in the 19th century, the physicists, still felt there was a need for a concept of ether, because ether would explain how light can go through a vacuum. Because it's observed, if you take, say, a glass chamber and you pump all the air out of it, sound, as we know it, can't go through that. But light keeps going through. So they thought, well, there must be something there that you're not pumping out which conducts the light. So that they called ether. Well, they were thinking of it as a substance which is within space. That's how they were thinking. And they had problems with it because they thought, well, it has to be a very rigid substance. Because the reason for that is that the more rigid something is, the faster vibrations will go through it. For example, sound goes much faster through, say, a steel rod than it goes through air. So light goes very fast, 186,000 miles per second. So whatever conducts light would have to be very rigid. But yet ether doesn't stop you from moving. So this seemed paradoxical. So they had problems with it. In any case, finally, with Einstein's theory of relativity, they kicked out ether. And it's been customary since then for scientifically trained people to say, well, ether was rejected by Einstein. Einstein, however, said that no, ether is an essential feature of his system, because he just said we changed our ideas about what ether is like. In his system, he has curved space, which means something is there that makes up space. He said space itself is something. It's not the absence of things, but it's a plenum. It's a real thing. So Einstein was really saying that space is something, and you can call it ether if you like. So he has the idea of ether. Yeah.
When you said that if there's a non-physical entity that directs the brain from beyond, that refutes the law of conservation of energy, why is that?
Well, because the idea is that they have equations. The question is, why does the idea that a non-physical entity causes the brain, say, to move your arm, why does that violate conservation of energy? Well, the reason is that they have their laws of physics in which they have different terms, quantum wave functions and so on and so forth. So these equations don't have any terms for this non-physical entity, mind, let's say. So if mind causes something to move, then it's upsetting the energy balance. For example, suppose mind causes an atom to start moving, which wasn't moving before. Well, now it's got energy that it didn't have before. So that violates conservation of energy from their point of view, because first it didn't have the energy, now it has it. Where did the energy come from? So because they don't recognize mind as an element in their system of equations, it couldn't be coming from mind. However, the solution is simple enough. Your system of equations is incomplete. There's another energy called mind. And when mind moves the atom, it imparts energy to the atom because it has energy in its own right. So it can do that. So that means you still really do have conservation of energy. So to really understand conservation of energy properly, you'd have to go to the level of pradhan, which is the ultimate source of material energy. But of course, even that wouldn't really be sufficient, because you'd ultimately have to go to Krishna, who's the original source of all energy. Because if Krishna wants, he can just manifest anything. He could manifest a planet just like that, which would be a tremendous violation of energy, according to the principle of E equals mc squared. So you take the mass of the planet and multiply by the speed of light squared, and that's the amount of energy you need to build a planet. But Krishna could do that because he has an unlimited reservoir of energy that he can use. Yeah?
You're saying that everything happens within space, in the material world?
Yeah.
But actually, subtle energy is like mind intelligence and policy. You don't actually have to think of it more subtle.
Yeah. Well, but when I said that, I meant the gross manifestations, namely everything made of air, water, fire, water, and earth. Because, yes, it's a fact, mind, intelligence, and false ego are beyond ether. So they're not within ether, actually. Yeah? Go ahead.
You were saying Krishna's the cause of Pradhan's the cause of the spirit soul, and you said he's the link between false ego and consciousness. You're describing how matter appears to take on consciousness.
Yeah. Well, by link, I'm thinking of a communication link, because the soul will to do something, and then matter goes into action and does it. So that means you have something going from the soul to matter, and it's a causal chain. And then matter will do something, and the soul becomes aware of it. So that's going from matter to the soul. So you have a two-way communication link, as it were. That's what I meant by link. There's an interaction between the soul and matter. Yeah?
It sounds like the scientist conception and the Sartre sound activity in Buddhist philosophy.
Which Sankhya? The atheist, you mean?
Yes.
Perhaps the Buddhist philosophy, I'm not really expert in it, but they ultimately say that everything is void somehow. Although I've also been informed that their void is supposed to be a full void or something like this. in any case, they don't have a supreme personality of Godhead. So in that sense, it is analogous. Yep.
Yeah. So when it
Well, avyakta means unmanifest. From,
and then when it becomes manifest as mahat-tattva.
Yeah, mahat-tattva. Or in the Bhagavatam, in the verses coming up, it's said to be pradhan, and then when Mahavishnu glances over it and sets everything into motion, then it's called mahat-tattva. Yeah?
Another, just a comment. When you were giving the example of books contain knowledge that don't possess knowledge, the one exception would be when they are descriptions that we own and we must be.
Yeah, but those aren't just regular material books.
Yeah. But I just thought I mentioned there's a lot of us, the main books that we deal with, so just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, the point is that the Shastras are not like that, because actually they're non-different from Krishna. So therefore, they're not just regular material books. Of course, in one sense, everything is non-different from Krishna. But in another sense, it is. It's a question of consciousness. Krishna is there within every atom, so he has full knowledge of everything. So in one sense, there's total knowledge everywhere. But the material structure in and of itself does not have knowledge. But Krishna, who is there, has knowledge. And Krishna is everywhere. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.